Coming up on Tech Nation, our 2002 interview with Andy Grove, the former CEO and chair of Intel, who passed away recently. We talk about his youth in war-ravaged Hungary and his experience with hearing loss as a result of an early childhood illness. Then Jim Hoff, a professor of experimental physics from the University of Glasgow. He'll explain the importance of the scientific news that scientists have measured gravitational waves. Then on Biotech Nation, a Canadian company's drug to treat cardiovascular disease, not simply in general, but specifically in diabetics. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
One of my favorite experiences about having teenage sons comes from Dick Maltzman in Palo Alto. Years ago, when his sons were teenagers, he announced, "I knew the exact moment that I had earned too much money. One of my sons drove one of my Mercedes into another one of my Mercedes, driven by another one of my sons, and they did it in my own driveway." Well, who could argue with that? I hadn't thought of this incident for years, decades in fact, but it popped into my head when I read the Washington Post headline, "Self-driving cars nearly collide in California," news service says. Google denies reports. It finally occurred to me that Dick's kids must have had a flock of denials at the ready, as teenage boys always do. But Google? Well, for starters, this was a near collision, not an actual one. According to a real live human traveling in one of the car he was traveling in was preparing to change lanes when the other driverless car cut them off, forcing abandonment of the lane change. This gets better all the time. Did the passengers in their respective driverless cars yell at each other and make hand gestures? What the heck happened anyway? According to Reuters, the first car, an Audi equipped by Delphi Automotive with lasers, radar, cameras, and special computer software, was getting ready to make a lane change. It was the second car, a Lexus from Google, which did the cutting off, if you're to believe the passenger. And why not believe the passenger? It was John Absmeier, Global Business Director for Delphi Automotive's Automated Driving Program. One driverless car spotted another? You don't think these two cars were playing chicken, do you? The key to all this may be that the second car is described as having similar hardware and software. The use of the term similar when it comes to hardware and software is a sucker bet. They're designed to do the same things, but they're built by two different teams of humans. That means the logic is different, and in any set of circumstances, the two will act differently. Count on it. This may be the first incidence in the wild of one manufacturer's driverless technology coming up against another. And frankly, I think they did well. There was no collision. Since the Audi from Delphi had a driver in the driver's seat as backup, if he or she wanted to chase after the other car in response, he could. You know that dumb cut-off payback move where you get in front of the car that cut you off and keep putting on your brakes for no reason? I don't think that's an automatic option on either car's computer. But if you can manually take over the steering wheel, you've got it made. Seven companies are testing some 50 driverless cars in the state of California, and the state recently released its first ever report regarding related accidents. To date, not a single driverless car has been at fault, but someday it has to happen. Two driverless cars from different manufacturers will collide, and then, well, there has to be a fault. I wish with all my heart that Dick Maltzman would be there to witness it. After all, Delphi's two Audis and Google's 20 Lexuses. Forget who's at fault. Maybe they just have way too much money. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, our final interview with Andy Grove, the former CEO and chairman of Intel Corporation, who recently passed. We'll talk about growing up in Eastern Europe during a time of armed conflict and the experience of being profoundly deaf. I'll also speak with University of Glasgow professor Jim Hoff, who'll explain the measurement of gravitational waves, a groundbreaking scientific effort. Then on Biotech Nation, a drug which treats cardiovascular disease, not simply in general, but specifically in diabetics, and how it does it with epigenetics. After Gordon Moore and Bob Noyce founded Intel Corporation, the first person they recruited was Andy Grove, who had previously worked for Gordon at Fairchild Semiconductor. Eventually, Andy rose to be CEO and chairman, and it was under his stewardship that Intel produced such famous chips as the 386 and the Pentium. Intel originally started by manufacturing memory chips, but this move to microprocessor chips drove revenues from $2 billion a year to $26 billion and was responsible for much of the personal computer revolution. As an author, Andy wrote many books on many topics, from college textbooks to management and leadership books to a memoir. His most famous is the management book Only the Paranoid Survive. In this interview, we talk about his memoir, Swimming Across, where he describes contracting scarlet fever at the age of 3. The result was that he lost half the hearing in both ears. I asked Andy about that experience and about growing up without the assistance of modern hearing aids.
People had to speak up for me to understand them. I had to sit in the front row in school. And if I sat 2 feet away from the teacher and the teacher spoke to the whole classroom, then she spoke, typically she spoke loud enough for me to hear. So it kind of worked out. Kids I could always understand because kids were always yelling. What was harder to participate in a group conversation. So there were limitations on the social circumstances that I had to arrange for myself to participate in. But, you know, like with every other disability, you adjust to that. The adjustment got a lot harder once I started to go to university because the big lecture rooms didn't help. In the big lecture rooms, it didn't help a whole lot to sit in the front row because the instructor, professor was far enough from the front row so that the sound volume wasn't really sufficient, so I had a harder time in the university.
Were you getting like phrases, or could you hear the whole thing?
I missed a lot, so it's not. I got many words, and I did not get many other words. And one way you adjust to a disability is your other senses kind of kick in. So I would develop a certain facility in lip reading and interpreting body English and gestures, sort of a poor man's sign language, which we all are engaged in normal course of talking, but you don't normally consider those as part of the talk, part of the communication process. But when you miss about a bunch of words, these gestures and lip reading help bridge over those holes.
Memoirs we usually talk about in chronological order, but we're not going to do that. We're going to take some of these themes and go through. That was at age, say, 3 or 4 when you first lost your hearing. Unfortunately for you, being able to hear before that is a tremendous help in being able to lip read and understand.
Correct observation.
Absolutely essential there. And you didn't receive your first hearing aid until you were in the United States in 19 or 20?
Correction. I had a hearing aid in Hungary. It was a Russian-made hearing aid, and it was basically useless. It distorted sound so it amplified them, but rendered them incomprehensible in the process of amplification. And it was very, very bulky too. So my first experience with hearing aid was awful. When I came to the U.S., courtesy of the International Rescue Committee, which is the agency that sponsored me here, and incidentally, I'm dedicating the proceeds of the book to support their work with it, bought me a modern American hearing aid. And this hearing aid was the size of a matchbox. I mean, by today's standards, it was huge. By the standards of the Russian hearing aid that I had, it was tiny beyond belief, and most importantly, it worked. It amplified without too much distortion, so for the first time, I really had a hearing aid that aided me in hearing, and I was 20 years old.
And that was $300 in 1956. You could almost buy a house. It's an amazing story in technology. You go from a Russian hearing aid, which sounds like it was quite large.
Yes.
I don't know, a Palm Pilot size?
No. It was bigger than that.
Really?
I would say it weighed probably 3 or 4 Palm Pilots, and then it had a battery pack that I had to that was connected to it by a wire that I had to put in my pants pocket. That was like maybe a half a pound of batteries, big, bulky flashlight battery-sized batteries. So that the whole contraption together was probably a pound. And we go from that to a 1 ounce match-size hearing aid that I could put in my shirt pocket and contained the battery. So it was a dramatic comparison.
And the leap today. Today, do you still wear hearing aids?
No, I don't. The leap today is punctuated by 5 reconstructive surgeries in the 70s that, bit by bit, rebuilt my ears and my hearing bones and reconstructed my eardrum. So now I have close to normal hearing.
Medical technology. Beyond the hardware.
Now, interestingly enough, by the way, a footnote on that, the reconstructive surgery, the reconstruction of eardrums, was initiated in Germany after the war because so many people punctured their eardrums with as a result of explosions, bombing, and the like, that there was a war-induced epidemic of hearing loss and punctured eardrums, and surgeons there started experimenting with reconstructive surgery. So this surgery that I had 20 years later was developed as a response to the aftermath of the war.
You're listening to a 2002 interview with former Intel CEO and chair Andy Grove, the former CEO and chair of Intel who passed away recently. You're listening to Tech Nation. This is just one dramatic example of something, of a technology that started, first of all, for many years, for many people, there was no technology available. And then we go to very bulky technology that doesn't work particularly well, and then it gets smaller and smaller, the march to smaller technology, which Intel, of course, has been so dramatically involved in. And then we're able to make so many medical headways. At the same time, your point about the effects of war and the effects of living with this type of thing spawn not only technology afterwards, but frequently some things that I didn't know about, some simple technology being in war-torn areas. At one point, you're describing how your house is being bombed. You're all in the basement, everyone in all the apartments, and two shells have come through the roof, and you go up there, and the attic is spread with sand. Now, I'm assuming that had something to do with the possibility of being shelled.
Well, the irony of this is pretty significant. During the communist years in Hungary, we were preparing for World War III. And the idea was that the government was trying to spread that we have to be on the alert because the imperialist Americans are going to attack us. So to prepare ourselves from American bombing attacks, we removed all the stuff from the attic and covered, well, we were told to do this, we covered the grounds, the floor of the attics with sand to protect ourselves against incendiary bombs. Well, the Americans never attacked Hungary, but the Russians did put down the Hungarian Revolution and the two incoming shells that you referred to that hit our attic and would have set fire to our house were of Russian origin. And the sand that we put in there to protect ourselves from the upcoming American attack came in very handy, protecting us from the flames of the Russian shells.
One of the things that we do today is if anything happens, we turn on all the televisions, we turn on the internet, we watch, click through what's happening 24 hours a day. And you talked about being glued to the radio, listening to, I think it's the Rajic trial. I may pronounce that. Rajic trial, R-A-J-K trial.
Right.
Were you able to hear the radio very well with your hearing?
Well, I stuck my ear next to the radio and turned the radio volume on so that it would be uncomfortable to everybody else in the room. But that's how I coped with the fact that I didn't hear well.
But tell us about that trial and how would it relate to the same kind of, you know, glued to O.J.'s car chase kind of thing that we see today?
Well, it was very different because it had a great deal of political significance. It wasn't a one-off thing. Reich was a member of the communist cabinet, a minister, and very much part of the communist regime. And all of a sudden, they arrested him, and after some months, put him on trial for being a spy for the imperialist Americans, English, the Western world. And the whole thing had a very, very improbable taste to it. It's a little bit like if the attorney general was arrested and tried for being a spy for the bin Laden terrorists. There would be a bit of a disbelief associated with that. Well, there was similar disbelief associated with this. But then when the trial came, he openly and in a broadcast session confessed to his crimes. So the eerie fascination gave to even more shock as you listen to the man, a well-recognized voice, confess to his crimes for spying, very general terms, never very specific, to spying for the imperialists. And subsequently he was executed. Now, the significance of this was not he himself. Significance for all the rest of us was that it signified a change in the repressiveness of the regime and change in the tension level that associated all political manifestations. Because if Reich could be tried and executed for spying, the improbable act of spying for the Americans and the English, who could be next, who would be next. And in fact, there were a lot of nexts.
You're listening to a 2002 interview with former Intel CEO and chair Andy Grove. We're talking about his autobiography, Swimming Across. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. One of the points for me is this is a very early example of once something, some communication or medium was available in general, like the radio, it immediately becomes a portion of propaganda, whether it's for the government or corporations or anything like that. The whole idea that they could galvanize the populace through this medium, through this trial, I mean, it's pretty enormous.
Well, radio those days represented the only means of reaching mass audiences. This was before the time of television in Hungary. Television simply didn't exist during this period of time. Internet obviously didn't. Newspapers could be shut down very rapidly, but whoever controlled the radio could communicate with the population as a whole. So interestingly, I described the beginning of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 there, and the revolution really kicked into high gear when the students marched on the radio station wanting to have their 12-point demands read on the radio waves on Radio Budapest. And the security police surrounded the radio station and opened fire on the demonstrators, and actually people got killed in the process. So the struggle for the radio station was what kicked the revolution from a demonstration into a shooting, real, honest-to-goodness confrontation. And it is not, I don't think it's accidental, because basically it was a struggle for the power to communicate with the masses of Hungary and beyond.
My guest today is Intel Chairman Andy Grove, a Time Magazine's Man of the Year. You may remember his earlier books, including Only the Paranoid Survive. Today we're talking about Swimming Across, his memoir. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation. You started out studying chemistry in Hungary, and then when you came to the United States, you started out studying chemistry. But then at one point, you made a very important switch. You went from chemistry to chemical engineering. What is the difference, and why did you do that?
Well, that one point happened in my first day of registering at a college to continue my studies in chemistry, when I realized that because of the requirements of a liberal arts degree, which chemistry was a liberal arts, I never knew liberal arts from anything before. I never heard that phrase before. But when I got credit for the courses that I'd taken and somebody laid on me the requirements of literature, history, social science that I have to take, I realized that that leaves me an minuscule amount of class time to really become a chemist. And keep in mind, I was in my second year of the university. I was, in my mind and in reality, very, very far from being a graduate chemist. And then I saw the prospect that I could only take two or three more classes and then I'm supposed to be a chemist. And that didn't add up to me. So I started protesting and said, I won't be a chemist if I graduate. I said, well, this is a liberal arts degree. These are the requirements, and you have to take them. And you, all the rest of the courses you get taken to you get taking chemistry. And no matter how much I protested that there was nothing, that's how it was. So after I whined about it for a while, somebody said, you know, if you want more heavily technical curriculum, why don't you switch into engineering? So I was so frustrated with my this picture that I just painted, that I said, okay, where do I go to become an engineer? And they sent me to an engineering school, and then one thing followed another, and ended up that same afternoon switching my degree, switching my school, and registering myself as a chemical engineering student at City College, where there was a sea of technical courses that I had to take, and I was happy as pig in the proverbial muck.
You're listening to a 2002 interview with former Intel CEO and chair Andy Grove. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Having myself been in both science and engineering, there's no doubt in my mind that they are two different disciplines in thinking. And yet, to my mind, they're both essential to technological innovation. What are the various roads? How does science and engineering relate in technological innovation?
Oh, I think there's a continuum to that. I don't look at them as that distinct, particularly since what actually ended up happening is after I graduated from City College, I got a PhD in chemical engineering, but my PhD thesis was fairly basic dealt with fairly basic physical phenomena in fairly basic ways. So I ended up kind of full circle ending up in a pretty scientific branch of engineering. So I don't see them as distinct as the curricula make them out to be. The actual practice is probably more of a continuum.
I always think that sometimes science leads the way and technology follows, and sometimes technology leads the way and flings science ahead.
Sometimes you make a technological breakthrough heuristically, and you go back to science to fill in the gaps and figure out why something that you stumbled across works in the first place.
Well, Andy, thank you so much. There's so much I haven't asked you about. You're always welcome on the show.
Good.
My guest today is Andy Grove. His autobiography is Swimming Across. It's published by Warner Books. You're listening to Tech Nation. You've been listening to a 2002 interview with former Intel CEO and chair Andy Grove. Andy passed away on March 21st at the age of 79. He left behind a lot, including a part of everyone's computer experience. So we'll just end with a few well-known quotes from Andy. We'll start with, "You need to plan the way a fire department plans. It cannot anticipate where the next fire will be. So it has to shape an energetic and efficient team that's capable of responding to the unanticipated as well as to any ordinary event." He's describing readiness, the ability to respond, to be agile. And then there's the lesson is, we all need to expose ourselves to the winds of change. But always, he said, be especially careful when you achieve success. And Andy was very clear about that. He wrote, "Success breeds complacency. Complacency breeds failure. Only the paranoid survive." I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, we look at a drug that treats cardiovascular disease, not simply in general, but specifically in diabetics. It's all about the epigenetics. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. Every year, scientists from all over the world come to the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This year, the big news was that scientists had finally measured something which Albert Einstein predicted some 100 years ago, gravitational waves. Now, we all know about gravity. We feel it in our bodies. Like Isaac Newton in the 17th century, we can hold an apple and release it and it falls to Earth. We can do that with any object we can hold in our hand. But it turns out we understand very little about gravity, even the scientists. Today I speak with Jim Huff, a professor of experimental physics and the emeritus holder of the Kelvin Chair of Natural Philosophy at the University of Glasgow. I couldn't decide which of two questions to start with, so I asked them both together. What are gravitational waves, and why should we care?
A long time ago, Isaac Newton had a theory of gravity, and in fact, that explained why the Earth went round the Sun and why, you know, the other planets went round the Sun very happily. But Newton knew there was something wrong with his theory, because he knew that if something happened very far away, according to his theory, you would know immediately, and that didn't seem right to Newton. But it took about 400 years till Albert Einstein came along with his special theory of relativity that said that no information could travel faster than the speed of light. And of course that was well known, in a sense, very quickly after this theory. And we all tied it in, of course, at that time with the fact that Maxwell's equations could explain radio waves, and radio waves travelled at the speed of light. But there had to be something equivalent, though, for gravity, and so people thought there must be some way that gravity was transmitted. Well, time went on, and then in 1915, Albert Einstein developed his theory of general relativity, which is really a theory of what gravity is about. And a year later, he could show from this theory that, in fact, that there was a wave solution to his equations of general relativity, and that these waves, called gravitational waves, would be how gravitational disturbances would be transmitted in the universe.
So gravity is a wave?
Well, gravity itself, nobody knows what gravity is as yet. It's unlike the other forces of, you know, the electric force, or the forces to do with radioactivity. They are understood now, but nobody actually knows what gravity is. And of course, that is what is particularly exciting, you know, to work in this field. And so Einstein predicted that these gravitational waves would exist. If we backtrack slightly, many people feel that his general relativity theory was very exotic and really didn't matter to them in daily life. But it turns out that one of the things his theory predicted was that clocks would run at a different speed in different, you know, strengths of gravitational field. And of course, our satellite navigation systems, which use clocks and satellites, have to take this into account, because the clocks and satellites actually tick at a different rate from clocks on Earth. And this has to be taken account of in the satellite navigation systems, or you would end up in the wrong place.
So you build them on Earth, and they operate one way all over the Earth, and then we send them into space and they operate differently?
They operate, well, the clock runs at a different speed once it's in space, because the gravitational field is different. And so therefore, general relativity matters, and in a sense, these gravitational waves, we really need to examine them more and look at where they're coming from, and more precisely see how they're generated, in order that we can check Einstein's theory somewhat better.
Now, can we measure gravitational waves?
Only now have we been able to do that. In September, for the first time, we made our first observation of a gravitational wave signal coming from far away in the universe, I think 1.2 billion light years away. In other words, it has taken the signal 1.2 billion years to get to us from this event.
Nobody was around to send that, right?
Presumably not. Presumably
okay.
Not.
All right. So something happened 1.5 billion years ago. What
yes.
happened?
Well, we know now that it was two black holes coalescing. Two black holes rotating round about each other and then coming together to form another black hole, which would be slightly smaller than the sum of the other two, because we know that it has given out an energy equivalent to three times the mass of the sun in doing this. That's a huge amount of energy has come out.
Now, what is a black hole? Remind us.
Okay, now a black hole is an object where the gravity is so strong that light cannot escape. That's why it's called a black hole. You can't actually see it because no light can get out of it. There has been no direct observation of black holes as yet. Always the presence of a black hole has been deduced from other phenomena taking place. Very often, if there's a small region of the sky where there's intense X-ray is coming from, one can see that there's something very active in the middle somehow causing this, and people can work out there must be a black hole there helping to cause this.
Because we're seeing so much energy, but we're not seeing
light. We're not seeing the black hole itself. Uh-huh. And so this is the first time through the effect of the gravitational field, black holes have been directly observed. Now, you might say, well, so what? You know, why does it matter? It's of great interest to the astronomy community, this, because they know how you can make small black holes of just maybe a little bit more than the mass of the sun, a few times the mass of the sun, and they can understand how huge black holes are formed. And in fact, there are huge black holes thought to exist at the centres of galaxies, like our own galaxy. Maybe there's a black hole there that's about a million times the mass of the sun. But these black holes we have seen are about 30 solar masses, about 30 times the mass of the sun each. And at the minute, the astronomy community doesn't really understand how these are formed. So it's an excellent new problem for our astronomical colleagues to work on and try to figure out what is happening.
So not only did we measure this billion and a half year ago event, knowing that it happened, we discovered that black holes could be a lot bigger than anything we imagined.
Certainly, there could be this range of black holes in the middle between small ones and very large ones that people did not expect, people did not really expect to be there. So it is a new discovery, this. And it will be very interesting to see what this leads on to, because it will certainly help our astronomer colleagues understand how, you know, stars are formed in some cases and how they evolve to form these sort of black holes.
Now, what was the detection methodology? I mean, we can talk about radio waves coming down and we can be watching them. What detected this?
Well, in a way, it's very similar to the way you detect a radio wave. To detect a radio wave, what you do is you take a piece of metal, that's maybe a quarter of a wavelength long of the radio wave, and you sense the current moving up and down, the electric current moving up and down. You amplify that up and, you know, convert that eventually into the sound that you want to hear due to the modulation on that electric field. So you've got to find a similar thing to do to look for gravitational waves. Now, what gravitational waves do is they stretch space a little bit. They kind of stretch space and let it go again. So they cause this oscillation in space. As say a gravitational wave was moving in toward you, the space in front of you would be distorted very slightly in and out, but only by a tiny, tiny amount. So you've got to build an apparatus that can somehow measure distortions in space. And so what we do is we take mirrors made of fused silica, hang them as pendulums a long distance apart. In the case of LIGO, the LIGO interferometers, you know, one at Hanford, one in Louisiana, these mirrors are spaced 4 kilometres apart. They're placed under vacuum so that air, etc., doesn't disturb them. And then a laser beam is run up and down to measure the distance between the masses. And in fact, what you have is you've got two arms at right angles to each other, and what you do is you compare the length of one arm with the length of the other arm using a device called a Michelson interferometer using high-power laser light, and look for tiny fluctuations, tiny disturbances in the differential length of the two arms.
So that means there was a gravitational perturbance.
A gravitational perturbance.
Exactly, because they should be identical.
But the difficulty is other things perturb it also. You know, there's seismic vibrations perturb it. even fluctuations, it's very slight fluctuations in the vacuum perturb it. The fact that at room temperature, the atoms and molecules in the pendulums and in the mirrors, they're all vibrating about. So there's a lot of noise sources like this that you have to overcome to make more and more sensitive apparatus.
But we finally did it.
We finally have done so, and we've been waiting a long time to do this. I've been working in this field for 45 years, and it has taken us all this time to get to the stage we're at now. But we've finally done it.
So you were sitting there detecting everything seems fine there, that we've taken all the noise in the system out. Basically, they're the same length. You've totally seen that, and suddenly they weren't the same length.
Well, all the time they're moving a little bit, of course, and so you get a lot of small signals out, but what you're looking for are really big signals where the two interferometers essentially do the same thing at more or less the same time. And, I mean, this particular event, the chance of it happening just by random fluctuations is it could only happen, I think, once in 200,000 years. So I think we're very confident that this is a real event.
So if we hadn't worked it out, we wouldn't have seen it?
We had to do a lot of work in thinking what you would expect and to look for particular types of signal to see it, that is right. Although this was a very big signal, you know. But these are not easy experiments. I mean, this experiment is funded by the National Science Foundation with input from the UK, from the Science and Technologies Facilities Council, from the Max Planck Society in Germany, and also the Australian Research Council. We've got 1,000 scientists working on it, and 15 different countries are all doing their bit in getting this to go.
Now, it seems to me there's a big leap between we're starting to see something different and, golly, there are two big black holes out there, and they collided, and they formed another one.
Yeah.
How did you get from A to B?
Yeah. Well, in a way, of course, people have been working for a long time. What would happen if you did have black holes, you know, like this, coalescing? So our theoretical colleagues have done a lot of work in modelling what kind of shape of signals that you might get, assuming general relativity is correct. And so they knew what type of signal to look for, and that was very helpful. But equally well, they're very interested to see if the signals are exactly what Einstein would have predicted, or whether there could be any deviations from Einstein's predictions. Because, as I said earlier, nobody knows what gravity is. Einstein's theory seems to work exceedingly well, but it is not like the other theories in nature. Because almost everything else can be quantized. Most other fields in nature can be quantized. That is, in the way that light can be thought of as little chunks, photons coming in. There's something about gravity that nobody knows how to do this for gravity. So there's a lot of work to be done still to understand what gravity is.
Well, Einstein didn't just write down words. He wrote down a lot of equations.
Yes. He wrote field equations, that is right, as did Maxwell. Maxwell wrote field equations for the electromagnetic field, the radio, you might say, which produced radio waves. But people know how to quantize all Maxwell's work. Nobody knows yet how to quantize Einstein's work. And that is one of the big kind of exciting areas for youngsters to come into, because somebody will make a fantastic discovery, you know, in trying to understand in managing to quantize the gravitational field.
And when someone writes down a mathematical equation, we can always put that into a computer, but as you say, we have to quantize. We have to be able to get data into those equations. How close are we on that? I like that. That was a good answer.
in a sense, this kind of experiment we've done is giving us real data to put into the equations and to test the equations with. But it still isn't helping us do the true quantization where, like in light, you can have little chunks of light, photons coming in. We'd like to know other things called gravitons, for instance, which are little chunks of fluctuating gravity coming in. We'd like to know that. And that's something as we try to compare what we'd expect from Einstein's theory and what we are seeing from this event and from future events. Maybe this is something we'll be able to do.
Now, we had two black holes collide. How long did that event take?
About 0.2 of a second, a fifth of a second it happened in. And what happened was you just get a little chirrup of signal, which lasts a fifth of a second.
But you could see it.
But we could see it in both detectors beautifully.
How quickly did you figure out that there was that this had happened versus somebody, you know, dropped a stone outside?
It was very fast, actually. It was within a few hours, certainly, that people there are systems that look at the signals coming out, looking for things like this. And initially, I think the initial observation was within something like, you know, an hour to 2 hours to show up there was something there.
What's the perspective of the scientific world? Is everyone in agreement that this is what happened?
I believe so. I mean, this event took place in September, and, you know, everybody has been examining this event now for whatever it is, nearly 5 months, I think, since then, and trying to see if there could be anything wrong with it, and looking at the detector carefully to try and see what's happening. And everything points to this event, you know, being what we would have expected if two black holes had coalesced like this.
What's the importance of understanding gravity?
Well, of course, as one really likes to understand the universe as a whole, and with the other fields, like the electromagnetic field, for example, the fact that it can be quantized and you can have photons there has led to a lot of developments in really quantum physics and applications of quantum physics to imaging and a whole range of things that are sort of practical value. That maybe if we can quantize gravity and understand how to quantize it, we'll see something similar that we can use, a little bit like how general relativity is now so useful for navigation. I mean, who knows, you know, what the next stage is. The thing is, with discovery physics, you rarely know at the time how it's going to be important. You know, 20 years later, radar is like that, GPS is like that, and general relativity, but you rarely know at the time.
It is true that once we understand something in science, then suddenly all manner of forces come into being to say, how could we use that?
That's right.
And just even trying to measure it or quantify it or contain it or sense it, that often leads to new products and new abilities that we've never had before.
But so does the technology. We've had amazing technological spin-off from building these systems and learning how to use them. We've made better lasers, which are now used in medicine, for example, in eye surgery, in making DVDs. Even one of my colleagues in Glasgow can claim that gravitational waves saves lives, because he is using a technique that he used to calibrate gravitational wave detectors now to stimulate and differentiate stem cells. The idea being that if you do this, you can select, I think, particular types of stem cells which can help wounds heal and help bones join together. So he claims that gravitational waves save lives.
You know, it's funny when I think about, like, trying to explain to people about, you know, electrical fields, electromagnetic fields, for example. Like, I'm not sure I understand. Everybody understands gravity. Everybody feels it. Right now, they're feeling gravity.
Everybody knows, that's right, if they're not careful and fall over, you know, that gravity is pulling them down. Because it's what governs your daily life, there's no doubt.
And I think knowing that we don't know a lot about it is almost a surprise in this day and age.
It is quite amazing that it is the one area that is not well understood, and even the constant that determines the force of gravity between two objects, that's known as big G, that is not known to nearly as high a precision as the equivalent kind of constants are for things like electromagnetism, for example. And it is just amazing how little we know about gravity.
Well, you are the emeritus holder of the Kelvin Chair, that's K-E-L-V-I-N, the Kelvin Chair of Natural Philosophy at the University of Glasgow. Is that Kelvin, Lord Kelvin?
That is Lord Kelvin, yes. And Lord Kelvin always said that until you could measure something, you really couldn't believe it was there. And this measurement of gravitational waves is exactly what he would have liked to have seen, you know, because he liked to actually measure things to believe that they're there. And the other great thing about Kelvin was he also liked to apply his knowledge. And he was the person, of course, who put in the first transatlantic telegraph cable. So, I mean, I hope that, you know, that those of us, you know, who have now discovered gravitational waves will also be able to find things that are going to be of real use, you know, in the future.
It's a great day for science.
It's a great day for science.
Well, thank you, Professor Huff. Come back. See us anytime.
Thank you.
The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we look at a Canadian company and the drug it's been working on. It treats cardiovascular disease, not in general, but specifically in diabetics. Don McCaffrey is the CEO of ResverLogix, located in Calgary. I asked him, how prevalent is cardiovascular disease in diabetes?
It is actually very prevalent. About 68% of diabetic patients die from cardiovascular disease.
Not diabetes.
Not diabetes. Cardiovascular disease. So it is a very important therapeutic target.
And you've been working on it quite a while. And since I spoke to you last, you've completed phase two studies. What did you learn?
We learned some very exciting data there in 55% reduction in relative risk of a target called MACE. MACE is major adverse cardiac events. That includes death, heart attacks, stroke, and major revascularization. So it's a very important reduction in the diabetic population inside that trial, which was about 40% of the patients. We actually had a 77% relative risk reduction. That's the first diabetes trial, or it wasn't a diabetes trial, but it's the first trial to show a reduction in MACE events. No other diabetic medication has ever shown that.
You also were able to determine that you were reducing plaque or plaque buildup, which we all always associate with cardiovascular events. How were you able to show that the plaque was reduced?
We used a procedure which would be deemed invasive, where you put a catheter right into the patient's heart and measure how much plaque is in a certain artery section. You dose that patient with the drug for 6 months, and you come back and you do the same thing. So it's not a lot of fun, but it is very effective.
Quite tricky.
Yes. So in our patients who were on rosuvastatin, that's Crestor, the procedure worked exceptionally well, and we were able to show some very high plaque regressions in those patients.
And now you go on to phase three in Europe.
Well, it most likely will be Europe. We're very excited about it. We've done a lot of our clinical trial work in Europe. We've worked in about 12 countries already. So we're pretty excited to see this drug moving forward into phase three.
How many people do you have to register?
We'll be registering somewhere around 3,500. And the reason I say somewhere is because it'll be an events-driven trial. We'll run the trial until we've had approximately 250 MACE events, major acute cardiac events, that being the death, heart attack, stroke. Then we'll measure against placebo to see which was effective.
You have to make sure you have enough failures to show the success of your drug and to compare it to those who weren't taking the drug at all.
Well, that's true. As ghoulish as that is, we actually want to see a lot of events, but we want to see them all in the placebo and not in the treated.
So it's a, you know, it's a really tough thing when we talk about these very serious, serious conditions that you can't just hope for the good side. It just doesn't work that way.
No, you do have to have the placebo. Even in the invasive procedure I described of the IVUS event, we also had placebos in there. We made it a smaller group. Only a quarter of them had placebo.
Tell us about your drug. I understand there's an epigenetic base to it. What does that mean?
Yes, there is. It's one of the world-leading epigenetic drugs. In bromodomain, it is a world lead by 8 years. So genetics, we all know what that is, the DNA. Epigenetics, epi means above in Latin. So I view it as the genetics is the hardware, the computer itself. Epigenetics is the software. How do you turn on or off those genes? You're not altering them. You're not changing them. You're turning them on or off. And that affects protein transcription, which allows us to get the results we get.
You are dealing with cardiovascular disease in diabetic patients. Will this have any potential in just general cardiovascular disease?
Yes, it has potential in cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and chronic kidney disease, as about 15% of all diabetics end up with chronic kidney disease. They're all very related diseases. And the population group in the seven largest global markets is over 18 million patients. So it is a very large market.
What's comparable? What do people take today?
Today you would take a statin like Crestor or Lipitor, and a statin is designed to stop further buildup of plaque in your arterial wall. It does not remove it. Now, in our case, the drug actually removes the arterial plaque.
Now, what happens to the plaque? Aren't you afraid of it sticking someplace else, or are you dissolving it?
No, that's a good question. When we remove the plaque, it's done in the form of it. You're creating new HDL molecules. They're kind of like a beach ball. When they're formed, they're empty. There's no air in them. When they fill up with plaque, then they leave to the liver where they're dumped and they recycle a few times. So you're actually moving the plaque to the liver where it belongs, where it leaves the body in the form of bile salts.
Using the natural function of the liver in that case.
That's correct. So you're turning the proteins back on that were functional at one point in time and non-functional now, and you're getting very positive health results. So we don't just remove the plaque. We've found through this epigenetic mechanism that there's a lot of other stuff going on based around anti-inflammatory, reducing glucose levels and increasing platelet levels in the blood. So there's a lot of benefit from one single drug.
It's very difficult considering the fact that you don't quite know when this phase 3 trial is going to end. How do you plan for that? How do you plan your finances? How do you pitch this to people and say, well, it could be this long, it could be this short. How do you do that?
Well, that's a really good question because we've just done that. And what we did is we sublicensed our product in China. And at the same time with our new partners in China, which is Shenzhen HepaLink, they make 70% of all the heparin in the world. We also arranged a $50 million financing at a very good premium price to market. So we're already in great shape to run this forward to 3,500, 4,500. We're financed up and ready to go.
Don McCaffrey is the CEO of ResVerLogix in Calgary, Alberta. More information is available on the web at resverlogix.com. A primer on epigenetics is also available, as well as a video animation. Manipulating epigenetics to adjust the functioning of genes is proving to be a promising new frontier in creating therapeutics for many health conditions, not simply cardiovascular disease and diabetics. More information on epigenetics and how it works is available at resverlogix.com. That's R-E-S-V-E-R. Logix, L-O-G-I-X, resverlogix.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos, and audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.